Welcome back to the second class. I see I've only scared away half the class by now. And that's kind of a record for me. Usually it's only a quarter or a third. But there's nothing to be scared about. In fact, today we're going to talk about a couple of topics that are relatively dry. Not that interesting, actually, except for the fact that you guys are going to be architects, and it's you who are going to have to figure your way through the minefield of licensing laws. Now, the licensing of architects is done at the state level. The state of Illinois and every other state in the country regulates the practice of architecture. It's not done at the national level. And almost all states have roughly similar systems. There are some differences, however. One of the key questions is, why bother to license architects at all? It's not as if architects are being licensed because they're professionals, because the Illinois Department of Licensure will license barbers and teachers and electricians and a lot of other jobs that really have nothing to do with being a professional. There are two reasons generally given for licensing architects. The first is to protect the public from incompetent design, specifically structural type problems, buildings failing, people getting hurt. There's a statute called the Illinois Architecture Practice Act, which is the basis for the regulation of architects. The regulation actually occurs at the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, which I've just been shortening to Department of Professional Regulation. The statute, the Illinois Architecture Practice Act, which is a statute, authorizes the Department of Professional Regulation to pass regulations. Now that's a statute, number two on the hierarchy of laws, authorizing this administrative agency to pass regulations, which is number four on the hierarchy of laws, that govern how an architect gets his or her license. It governs the education you need. It governs the 5 years of what used to be called apprenticeship, and now is given some other euphemism. It governs the description of the test that you have to pass in order to get licensed. In the Architecture Practice Act itself, it says that the purpose of the licensing is to make sure that architecture is practiced safely, so that buildings and other structures are safe for those who occupy them or those who live near them or enter them as guests or whatever. And I suppose there's a certain modicum of truth to that, but it's really window dressing. That's not the real reason that the Architecture Practice Act and all the regulations got passed. The real reason they got passed is the second reason listed up here, to regulate competition. Really, that means to exclude competition. Architects did not want others who called themselves designers but didn't have their training and background to practice architecture. Architects themselves wanted the requirement of licensing so that the public was only allowed to go to them for architectural services. Before the licensing acts existed, 150 years ago, somebody who wanted a building designed could go to anybody. And that person, if they had the ability, could prepare a set of drawings from which a contractor would build, or build it him or herself. And that took business out of architects' pockets, which they didn't like. Now, how do we know that that's the case? Well, if you look at the actual history of the law, who lobbied for it, who lobbied against it, you'll see that the architects were for regulating themselves. Sounds a little counterintuitive. Why would architects want to make a whole bunch of regulations and other restrictions that apply to themselves? Well, the answer is that once they were grandfathered in or had passed these hurdles, then other people who hadn't passed the hurdles wouldn't be able to practice architecture. Now, one of the groups that lobbied against the Architecture Practice Act were structural engineers. They wanted their own licensing act that licensed them and only them to practice structural engineering. So a political compromise was reached. The Architecture Practice Act says that structural engineers can practice architecture. The Structural Engineering Act says that architects can practice structural engineering. By reaching that compromise, the two lobbying groups basically combined forces to get these statutes passed and to try to exclude everybody else from honing in on their professions. Recently, this happened, well, recently by my standards, not by yours, this happened too. I was for a while the general counsel to what was called the, I think, Chicago Interior Design Organization. It was a lobbying group, really, that tried to get the Illinois State Legislature to pass a law licensing interior designers for the exact same competitive reason. Interior designers didn't want people who called themselves interior decorators but didn't have their training or experience to horn in on their business and to take their clients. So they looked for a statute from the Illinois legislature that was a lot like the Architecture Practice Act. But there were a lot of people who pushed back, claiming that pure interiors work, which didn't include structures, didn't have the same kinds of safety ramifications to it. There were some issues of fire spread and materials and stuff like that. But as a result, a different kind of statute ended up getting passed for the interior designers that we'll be talking about in a moment. Now, these regulations that the Department of Professional Regulation passed are somewhat quasi-civil, quasi-criminal. Remember we talked about the distinction between criminal law and civil law? Criminal law really protects the state. That's the only law that can allow for imprisoning somebody or making them pay a fine to the government. Even traffic laws are a kind of criminal law, usually misdemeanors. But the regulations from an administrative agency like this kind of cross the divide between civil and criminal, because there can be quasi-criminal type penalties for violating the Architecture Practice Act and its regulations. If you're caught practicing architecture without a license, you can be fined, just like for a speeding ticket, except the numbers can be higher. You can actually be thrown in jail for repeated violations. I mean, I've never seen it happen in the history of Illinois, I believe, but it's one of the sanctions that the law allows. A more common kind of sanction occurs if you are practicing kind of moonlighting on your own while you're working for somebody else waiting to take the exam. Because then, if you've been caught practicing without a license and you're punished by the agency, one of the sanctions can be that they won't license you even when you are otherwise able to be licensed. You may pass the exam, have your 5 years of work experience, and they still can deny you a license because of your inappropriate activity practicing before you were licensed. Again, I really haven't seen it happen, but it's one of the sanctions that it allows. A much more common result of practicing without a license is the inability to sue for fees. Why do I say this is more common? Because the Illinois Department of Regulation is understaffed. It's one of those agencies whose budget gets cut all the time when the state's trying to pare down expenditures. So they have very few people involved in enforcement. And that means that they really aren't pounding the pavement looking for people who have set up shop as an architect when they aren't truly licensed. They kind of have to wait by their desks for somebody to call them and complain. And that doesn't happen all that often. The way you usually get in trouble practicing without a license is when your client skips you. When you've performed services and the client refuses to pay. Well, how do you collect a fee that you're owed when your client wrongfully doesn't pay? You go to court or whatever, just as we talked about last week. But there's a rule in the courts that says that if you have been practicing architecture illegally, i.e. without a license, that means that the courts won't help you. They won't help you collect your fees. And in reality, that means that you are unable to sue to collect your fees even if there's a real contract that the other side has breached, because you're practicing illegally, and the courts will not enforce an illegal contract. This usually happens because of oversight. There aren't too many people who are stupid enough to practice without a license knowingly and still go to court to collect an architectural fee. It usually happens when somebody accidentally lets their license lapse, or more commonly, when they may be individually licensed, but they've set up a company, a corporation or something like that, to be their architectural firm, and that company isn't licensed, so actually the party to the contract isn't licensed to practice architecture. We're going to talk about setting up a company in the second half of this class. Now, the types of statutes that regulate the practice of architecture vary from state to state. Some states have what's called a holding out statute. Holding out. That means that it's illegal for anybody to claim to be an architect, to put an ad in the Yellow Pages that says architect, to put a sign on your front door that says architect if you're not licensed. It's really not allowed to advertise statute. That's the kind of statute that the interior designers have in Illinois, for example. They're simply not allowed to call themselves an interior designer unless they've actually been licensed. A different kind of statute is called a practice statute. A practice statute is one that doesn't regulate advertising at all. It regulates what you can do. It says that no one is allowed to practice architecture without being licensed to do so. Those statutes always have definitional type issues. The big one is, what does it mean to practice architecture? I mean, we all know what it means to sit at a drafting table or a computer to prepare a set of construction documents. But there are a lot of activities that architects do that other professions do as well, and yet it's considered part of architecture as well as part of something else. So you know that the last phase of your architectural duties is construction administration, right? You walk the project, you observe the construction in place, you may analyze pay requests and approve them, respond to RFIs, which are requests for information, typical types of things that an architect does during the construction phase of the project. But architects aren't the only people who do that. Construction managers do the same thing. Owner's representatives do the same thing. They walk the site, they look at the construction, they analyze pay requests, they respond to requests for information, all kinds of things that other professions do that an architect also does. So exactly where does the practice of architecture begin? I mean, how about planning? There's programming and preliminary planning that's all a part of architecture. It's part of the architectural process. But there are all kinds of consulting firms that do programming and planning without actually practicing architecture. It's just business consulting. If your client is a hospital, there are all kinds of healthcare agencies that come in and help them plan the number of emergency rooms they need for this kind of population, etc. And although it's the practice of architecture, it's also the practice of other consulting professions. So there are always problems defining what constitutes practice, at least at the edges, not necessarily right in the middle. Illinois has a hybrid statute. It is both a holding out and a practice statute. It says that it's illegal to advertise yourself to be an architect if you're not one. And it also says it's illegal to practice architecture if you're not licensed to be one. It's a combination of the two. There are ways to practice architecture, though, without being licensed. This is one that everybody always trips up on. The most common, and the ones that most of you will go through for about 5 years, is, I mean, to use a short word, apprenticing. You can practice architecture unlicensed if you do so under the supervision of a licensed architect, which is what most young architects in architecture firms do. No mistake there. Another way that you can get licensed, even if you haven't gone through all of the hurdles that the statute puts out for you, is if you're licensed in a different state. there are a lot of states that give other architects from other states what's called reciprocity. Reciprocity simply means that if you're licensed in another state, we'll honor that license here, provided that your home state also honors our licenses in its state. There are a bunch of states that refuse to participate in reciprocity, mostly in the Sun Belt, you know, Florida, Arizona, California. Any idea why they refuse? That's a good guess. Hurricanes are geotechnical stuff in California, but it's not the real reason. The real reason goes back to this competition idea. Architects from the north tend to retire and move down south where the weather's better. And the local architects don't want competition from the newcomers moving into their area. If there were reciprocity, then all these retiring architects could take on an odd job here or there to keep them busy and interested in their retirement, taking work out of the mouths of the local architects. So they refuse to allow their states to grant reciprocity with northern states because it minimizes the competition. You'll find that although there are all kinds of great reasons offered for minimizing competition, including familiarity with hurricanes, with geotechnical issues in California, stuff like that, that's all window dressing. It really is all about the buck. Architects are trying to keep other people from taking projects out of their mouths. Now, the licensing structure seems very straightforward, no big deal about it, but it opens up some troubling questions. So, for example, I mean, if the real reason to license architects is to protect the public, why do you need to require a certain amount of education and a certain amount of apprenticing before you can get your license? Why not just test architects? And anybody who can test and pass the tests, meaning that they know have the skills and know what to do, ought to be licensed. I mean, if they can achieve a level of competency that's tangible and measurable on a test, why make them go through all the effort and the years of work before they can get their license? It boils down to bucks again, because the architecture schools insist on it being that way, or else they wouldn't have nearly as many students. Even the architecture firms like the idea of a pool of cheap labor, which is what you're going to be for 5 years, where they put you to work at a drafting table or a computer for what I think are slave wages. I mean, you have a 2-year graduate school here, right? Three? The law school is also 3 years. Now, what is a typical starting salary for an architectural intern or draftsperson right out of graduate school? And I've seen them take a lot less, depending on the position, the size of the firm. When my firm hires a new lawyer right out of law school, the starting salary is in the vicinity of
$125,000.
Even if they haven't passed the bar yet. In fact, what we do, just so you understand it, we subsidize their passing the bar. We give them essentially half days until the bar exam and the entire week of the bar exam off to help prepare. And usually the firms even pay for their bar review courses. I mean, it's just a totally different economic milieu. The architecture firms are hiring you at slave wages. You guys are every bit as skilled in your area as young lawyers coming out of law school, and in fact more so, because they're actually teaching you somewhat about how to practice here, at least how to draw and how to think. In law school, they all only teach lawyers how to be other law school professors. A lawyer doesn't really learn local law or how to practice or courtroom procedure until they start working and actually learn it on the job. So you're probably more competent as architects than first-year lawyers are as lawyers, and yet you're paid about one quarter as much. I think that architects, the entire spectrum of architects, are tremendously underpaid. From what I've seen, it's the most underpaid profession in the country. Lawyers are probably grossly overpaid. Doctors always had been overpaid, but the healthcare laws are bringing that back to likely to bring that back to a little bit more of a norm. But architects are grossly underpaid from what I can see, given the caliber of the expertise that you need to develop and the length of time it takes you to develop it. I don't know of any easy way to do anything about it. The problem is that architects compete with each other, that they're chasing the same projects, and that the developers and other people who hire them are very savvy business people and know how to force relatively low architectural fees out of the architectural firms, which is what governs the market then. Even the very top designers, the ones who, there's a handful of them in the city, don't earn more than $250,000 or so a year, whereas the top lawyers in the city, I mean, earn multiple millions. So it's a terribly underpaid profession. Here's another question for you. Do you think that architectural licensing really prevents incompetence? How many of you are aware, I mean, have met older architects in particular, those who have not been real serious about keeping up their skills, and have figured out that they're less competent than first and second year architectural graduates? The fact that they happen to have passed an exam a long time ago and now are dealing with a technology that makes them nervous doesn't make them any more competent. You would think that if the goal of the law was really to ensure that architects were competent, that they would have ongoing, not just education requirements, but ongoing testing. I mean, so that the 50 and 60 year old architects would be forced to understand at least CAD by now, if not BIM. And it just doesn't exist that way. If the real purpose is to keep the public safe, why not license contractors? Contractors have more to do with buildings being safe than architects do. I mean, you can design it to be safe, but if the contractor doesn't build it that way, all of your precautions go for naught. Many more accidents are caused by contractors than by architects, by a magnitude. So why doesn't the state of Illinois license contractors if its goal is the safety of the public? But it doesn't. Contractors have had a strong lobby in some way, which has prevented it from happening. I'm not sure exactly why.
Is that coming?
Is what coming? Licensed contractors? It's not real common. I would say that about a quarter to a third of the states in the country don't license contractors.
So is that all contractors or general
contractors? No, general contractors are what are not licensed in Illinois. Plumbing contractors are, electrical contractors are, because I guess those are deemed to be more technical construction elements than the civil work that most general contractors do. But Illinois does not license general contractors. Although the city of Chicago does, they don't really license them for competency. They license them in order to tax them, if they want to work in the city of Chicago. So if you're skeptical of the purposes of these laws, there's a good reason for you to be skeptical. We're going to switch to a different topic now. And I'm going to try to condense what would have been a solid year in a class of law school down to less than one class here. We're going to switch topics, and now we're going to talk about doing business, how companies do business, or more specifically, how you set up a company and what a company is. Corporations, you've heard of LLCs, partnerships, what are they and how do they function? Well, the way to understand all that is to start by understanding the law of agency. We'll end up talking about the concepts of agency dozens of times throughout the remainder of the class sessions. You probably all heard of the concept of an agent. I mean, a classical situation for agency would be an employer-employee. You've heard of a real estate agent, right? A real estate agent and its buyer or its seller. Or an agent for an athlete or for a Hollywood star or something like that. Those are all common examples of the agency relationship. What does it mean to be an agent? Well, agency is where somebody is working for the benefit of another party rather than him or herself. That's really the essence of it. The parties involved in an agency relationship are the principal, the agent, and the third parties. The agent works for the principal. I don't know if any of you followed sports. Remember Michael Jordan's agent when he was playing with the Bulls was a guy named David Falk, who was with a big, huge sports management agency. David Falk's job was to find opportunities for Michael, to negotiate his contracts, basically to handle the business side of Michael Jordan's career. When Hollywood agents operate, they do the same thing for their movie star type clients, because, you know, there are a lot of reasons that the stars themselves don't have the time, they don't have the expertise, and sometimes it's just hard to say good things about yourself. It's embarrassing. When a ball player is negotiating a contract, it's a lot easier for the agent to talk to the third party, like the owner of the team, and to say, this ball player is great, he has a 90 mile an hour fastball, etc. Whereas the player may find it embarrassing to talk about himself that way. So agents serve a very real function of doing stuff for other people, stuff they can't, won't, or don't have the time to do. And they do it for their principals with third parties. An employer-employee relationship is an agency relationship. When you think about it, you work for a company, let's say. Your job is to drive a truck. Well, you are doing something for the company that the company can't do for itself. Because the company, what is the company? It's not even bricks and mortar. It's a concept. It's a maybe an articles of incorporation or something like that. But it's just a thing. It doesn't have arms and legs. It can only operate through people who work for it. So the employee, by working for the company, is doing things for the company, on behalf of the company. If the company is obligated to deliver goods to somebody, it's the truck driver who loads them into the truck and drives them to the location. Now, an employee is just an agent for a limited purpose. You wouldn't expect the truck driver to go out and issue shares of stock in the company or to sign up for the company's loan, I mean from its bank. That's something that a truck driver just doesn't do. Each employee has a scope of employment, his job, basically. There are certain things that truck drivers do, and that's defined as the scope of his employment, and every employee is an agent for the company within that scope of employment. Real estate brokers are real estate agents in a way. They have information that a property owner doesn't. Anybody can put a for sale sign on their property, but the real estate broker or agent knows what the market is, knows what the smart price to ask is, knows how to locate buyers who are potentially interested in the property, and ends up acting as the agent for the property owner to try to effectuate a sale. Architects are the agents of their clients for certain limited purposes. We're going to talk about that when we talk about the specific documents. But if you are on the job site and you see defective construction work going on, and you go up to the contractor and you say, hey, that's wrong, you're going to need to rip it out and do it right, this is what it's supposed to be, not what you did, you're not doing that for yourself. You're doing that as the agent of the owner, conveying the owner's desire that the work be taken out and replaced with whatever it is you actually designed. Now, what are the effects of an agency relationship? What can an agent do, or what are the consequences of the agent acting? Well, one thing the agent can do is to bind the principal. Assuming that the agent is allowed to, the agent can commit the principal to a business obligation, sign him up to a contract. Michael Falk can sign papers that commit Michael Jordan to appear in a commercial for Hanes underwear or whatever it might be. Cameron Diaz's agent can sign her up for promo spots to promote her latest movie, whatever that might be. So the agent can commit the principal to things, which means that a principal has to be very careful in choosing his or her agent. That agent's got to exercise good judgment, or else that agent could bind the principal to bad things. Knowledge. If the agent has information about something, that information is attributed to the principal. Suppose you go to a complaint window in a department store, and you explain that somebody's doing something wrong or something bad is going on, that is how you communicate with the company. The employee is the agent for obtaining that kind of information. And once you tell the agent the information, it is legally deemed information that the owner itself knows, the whole company. Similarly, if the Hanes underwear commercial producer told David Falk that Michael Jordan needs to be on the set Monday morning at 9 a.m. for filming or for lighting tests or whatever it might be, that producer expects, once he communicates the information to David Falk, that it'll get to Michael Jordan. He doesn't have to call Jordan himself to communicate it. Communicating with the agent is just like communicating with the principal. If the contractor on the construction site says, well, here's one way that I could build it, the way that you designed it, but here's this other way that might save some money and I could offer a credit to the owner, which do you prefer? The contractor is expecting you to share that with the owner and for you and the owner to jointly make a decision. The contractor isn't expecting to have to tell the owner separately after the contractor tells you, because knowledge of the agent is attributed to the principal. And not just knowledge, but acts or omissions of the agent are attributed to the principal. There's a CTA bus driver, and before he starts his afternoon route, he has half a dozen beers at lunch. He gets in the seat of the bus and he's soused. Because he's soused, he drives terribly and he hits somebody and injures them. Now that injured person can certainly sue the bus driver. The bus driver was the negligent one who was driving drunk. You can always sue somebody who's negligent and causes your accident. But the injured person can also sue the CTA, for whom the bus driver works, because the bus driver is the agent of the CTA for the purpose of driving that bus. And if the bus driver committed acts that are improper or illegal or the basis of a lawsuit, then those acts are attributed to the CTA. And it's the CTA and its insurance policy that has to pay the injured person for the injury, because the agent's acts, if they're within the scope of his employment, are attributed to the principal. And the same is true of omissions. If the agent omitted to do something important, that's attributed to the principal as well. An omission is the same thing as an act. It's just the failure to act. So an agency relationship can have huge, important consequences. Which is why there are such strict laws governing an agent's performance. These laws tend to be called fiduciary duties. Fiduciary is an old Latin word. It comes from trust and estate law. It basically means that the agent has to put the principal's duties all above his own. The agent can't satisfy his own needs without first satisfying the principal's needs. And the most common fiduciary duties are loyalty. Loyalty means that the agent can't become adverse to the principal. Say you've hired a real estate agent because you want to buy a particular kind of property to locate your factory on, and you want it to be located here and inexpensively, etc. And the agent is looking for those properties for you. And in the process of looking, the agent comes across a great piece of property, tremendously undervalued in the marketplace. Why can't the agent just buy it for him or herself? Because the agent is working for you, and it would be disloyal of the agent to put his or her own interests in front of the principal's interests. So since you as the owner or the principal would want to buy that property, the agent would be disloyal by beating you to the punch, buying the property himself and taking it off the market so you can't buy it unless you're willing to turn around and pay the agent a profit for getting the property. That's disloyal. An agent can never be adverse to its principal. Another fiduciary duty is the duty of care, or you could call it skill perhaps. Not being negligent. An agent has an obligation to act with a reasonable degree of competence. The bus driver for the CTA isn't supposed to drink alcohol at lunch before getting back on his in his bus and driving. That's negligent, careless. Obedience. You have to obey the instructions of your principal if you are an agent. The principal has the right to instruct you to act in a particular way for him or her. I mean, Michael Jordan might instruct David Falk that he's only allowed to commit Michael Jordan to commercials that have a good that portray Michael with a good sense of humor. They can't have commercials that make him look silly or stupid. Well, David Falk, even if he's offered a lot of money for it, can't sign Michael Jordan up for a commercial that makes him look stupid, because that's violating the rule of obedience. How far does that rule go, do you think? Well, could a principal order an agent to do something that's illegal? The answer is no, and the reason is the hierarchy of laws. If you think about it, the relationship between a principal and an agent is really a contract-type relationship. One is hiring the other to act. That's level 6 on the hierarchy of laws. If the principal were to instruct the agent to do something illegal, violating a statute or a regulation, those are numbers 2 and 4 on the hierarchy of laws. They're higher up than an agency contract. And a lower law can never supersede a higher law. So you can't get around a statute by ordering an agent to violate it. That order would be void. You can't enter into a contract that's for an illegal purpose. That would be void. I remember that, I'll tell you this in more detail, probably next week, but one of my very first assignments as a construction contract lawyer was to prepare a contract for the design of I guess the easiest way to say it is a house of prostitution, a bordello. It was intended to be designed with a lot of bedrooms, a dungeon, things like that, and on the surface it's illegal. Prostitution is illegal, and to have a construction contract that called for, or design contract, that called for an illegal place to be built was illegal and simply unenforceable. Next week we'll talk about how to get around that, in case any of you are given a similar assignment. Notification. The other duty of an agent is to notify the principal. This directly follows the knowledge consequence that we talked about. If the agent's knowledge or information is automatically attributed to the agent's principal, well then the agent's got to have a duty to tell the principal what the agent knows. He's got to have a duty to notify the principal of this knowledge so that the principal really has it. If the agent is silent or misleading in that communication, that's a breach of the fiduciary duty. So those are the kinds of duties that agents owe to their principals. Now, question? Not really, if you think about it. Let's figure out from the hierarchy of laws. You have a friend who is acting as an agent for somebody, maybe an employee for a company. And through you've persuaded him or done something that persuades him to violate his duties. Let's say that your friend is the bus driver for the CTA. You meet for lunch, and you hoist a couple of beers, and although he's hesitant, you talk him into it. And you end up having persuaded him to get drunk and to get into his bus and drive. Have you broken any laws? No. It's not illegal for you to drink at lunch. It's not illegal for you to even talk somebody else into drinking with you at lunch. Have you broken any contracts or any other requirements of the hierarchy of laws? The answer is no. You haven't done anything illegal or improper. You might not be proud of what you've done, but it doesn't break the law. But it does break the law, in at least some ways, for that bus driver to have given in and done the drinking. So you're not automatically responsible just because you've persuaded a peer to violate his or her duties. As an employee of the company or agent of the principal, one of your duties is loyalty, if you end up intentionally frustrating the goals and purposes of your principal by locking somebody else out, then you probably violated the duty of loyalty. If you're just careless and you lock the door and don't listen to him pounding on it to get in, then you probably violated your fiduciary duty of care by being negligent in it. So it depends on each factual situation, but you might be in violation of your own fiduciary duties by stopping somebody else from performing theirs. Let's talk about the source of the agent's authority. How does somebody become an agent for a principal? Well, there are three ways. The most common way, the one that everybody thinks of, is what's called actual authority. All that means is that the principal says or writes to the agent or something like that and says, I want you to be my agent. When it's Michael Jordan and David Falk, they have an agency contract between the two of them that spells out exactly what the agent does for the principal. But it doesn't have to be in writing. It could simply be the agent verbally communicating that I'd like you to handle this for me, or other words to that effect. Question? Neither contract is dominant, but they are both effective. The contract between Michael and David Falk is effective to make David Falk the agent. But once David Falk signs a contract on Michael's behalf with a television producer that Michael doesn't like, that contract is still valid because David Falk is a legitimate actual agent, and the problem is going to be between Michael and David as to whether he violated his instructions in some way. So actual authority is the usual way that agency comes about. And the communication of the principal-agent relationship can be written, or it can be verbal, or it could even be kind of implied under the circumstances. If somebody has acted on your behalf, I guess, does anybody ever tell the employee, you are now the agent of the corporation? No one ever uses those words. Employees simply know that they're supposed to do their job and that that job entails certain agency-type duties. So it doesn't have to be explicitly word-for-word communicated as long as the concept is really communicated between the principal and the agent. Apparent authority is a different concept. Apparent authority occurs even if the agent isn't really the agent. It occurs when the principal leads some other third party to think that the agent or the person is the agent, even if he's not. This often happens in a situation where agency has been terminated. So, for example, suppose Michael Falk and David and Michael Jordan and David Falk have a falling out, and Michael fires David and just doesn't say anything about it to anybody. And the next day, Falk goes into the commercial producer's office and signs Michael up to another contract, just like the one that they did last year. Well, that commercial producer is going to believe that Falk is Michael Jordan's agent still, because he was before. There's no reason for him to think that things have changed. So if a principal fires his agent, it's pretty smart of the principal to send out notices to everybody they do business with, letting them know that David Falk no longer speaks for me. He's not my agent anymore. Have you ever seen some of the strange want ads in the newspaper that, you know, are all technical and they talk about how two people have split up and one is no longer acting for the other, no longer responsible for the debts of so-and-so, stuff like that? That's for the same purpose. Usually it's because, you know, married partners or partners living together, known to be living together, are usually deemed to be the agents of each other. And when they split up, they have to tell the outside world that they've split and aren't responsible for each other anymore, so that neither one is deemed to be the apparent agent of the other. Another way that apparent agency could come about is if I have a discussion with somebody and imply that you are my agent, even if I've never told you that. You and I have never spoken before or had any contact. So if you and I were talking, you'd have every right to believe, because I'm telling you, that she's my agent. even though she's not really, because I never really made her my agent. So when the principal creates that impression, the agent has apparent authority. But what more commonly happens is the other way around. The agent tries to create that impression with the third party, kind of bootstrapping. Somebody comes in off the street and sits down at Jerry Reinsdorf's desk and says, listen, I'm Michael Jordan's agent, and yes, I know he owns the Charlotte Bobcats right now, but he wants to make a comeback, and he'd rather play for the Bulls. What a publicity bonanza that would be for you. Why don't we sign him up to just a $1 million contract, which is cheap by basketball standards, and he'll be playing for the Bulls next year. Reinsdorf loves the idea and signs it on up. But Michael's not bound. This guy was never really Michael's agent. It's the guy who walked in the street and said, I'm Michael's agent. Any con man can do that. So the law doesn't allow the con man to bootstrap himself into really being the agent. It's got to be the principal, Michael Jordan, who lets Reinsdorf know, yeah, this guy's really negotiating on my behalf. When he says that, then there's apparent authority. The third way that agency can come about, and this isn't very common, is ratification. When the principal ratifies the deal, which means accepts it. Let's go back to that example I just gave you, where the guy off the street walks into Jerry Reinsdorf's office. Those of you who don't follow sports, he's the primary owner of the Chicago Bulls, and negotiates this great deal for Michael Jordan, even though he's never heard Jordan speak. Jordan doesn't know him from Adam. But then he goes and contacts Jordan after Reinsdorf has signed this great contract and goes to Michael Jordan and says, listen, you don't know me, but I just negotiated a deal with Jerry Reinsdorf that you will love. Here it is. Read it, and you tell me if this isn't fantastic. And Jordan reads it and loves the deal. It's just wonderful for him. He loves the publicity. He's only playing 5 minutes a game, or whatever it may be. And he then says, fantastic. Let's ratify it. I'll do it. Ratification is like agency after the fact. The guy wasn't the agent when he was negotiating the deal, but because the principal likes the deal afterwards, the principal says, okay, I'll pretend that you were my agent when you were negotiating it, and we'll ratify the deal anyway. 90%+ of agencies appear through actual authority, and the other 9% is through apparent authority. The ratification is pretty rare. But agency relationships, like any other relationship, can be terminated. It can end. It can end the same way it began, just by communication. If on day one I tell you that you're my agent and therefore you have actual authority, on day 10 I can tell you, you haven't made any progress, you're done, you're fired, you're not my agent anymore. And after that moment, you're not my agent anymore. I have withdrawn my actual authority. But if I want to be safe, what I will do is find out who you contacted during those 10 days and let them all know that you're not my agent anymore. Because otherwise, they legitimately think you are my agent, and you would have apparent authority with them. I could set up an agency relationship with you that says, you're my agent for 1 year, and at the end of that year, your rights expire, or your obligations expire. It's like doing a contract with somebody. You can agree to whatever terms you want to govern the relationship. The only time that I have trouble terminating you is if we've entered into a deal where you're expecting compensation from me. In other words, a deal where we've signed up for a 1 year term of agency and I'm supposed to pay you $1,000 a month. Well, if I terminate you prematurely, I've kind of breached the contract because I had promised to keep you my agent for 1 year and now I'm firing you after a month. Well, I may have breached the contract, so I may owe you money damages for breaching that contract, but you're still not my agent any longer. You can terminate the agency early. You just might have to face the consequences if you've signed an agency contract that doesn't let you terminate early.
I have a question about apparent authority.
Sure.
What if you don't know who the agent is contacting?
Very good point. You can get yourself in trouble by not monitoring your agent's actions. If you are going to fire your agent, and it's wise to contact everybody your agent contacted to let them know that he's not the agent any longer, it's a pretty smart thing for you to do to monitor who those contacts are. If for some reason you haven't, and you don't know whom to contact, you can have screwed up, because some person you are unaware of may think that this guy is still your agent, and he can end up binding you to something. So most agency agreements have the agent reporting in a regular manner on all his contacts in progress, so that the principal is made aware of what's going on. Now that we've talked about agency, and you're wondering why, we're going to try to make it relevant. And we're going to do that by talking about how architectural firms are set up, because they all revolve around concepts of agency in one way or another. One kind of architectural firm, or I could say one kind of company, is a sole proprietorship. That's just a fancy word for hanging out your shingle. It's basically going into business on your own. There's no separation between the individual and the business. The individual is the business, and the business is the individual. So there's no separate company or anything else like that. You can have a name. You can call yourself ABC Architects, but you are ABC Architects, and there is no distinction between you as the human being and you as the company. That means that any money that you earn in your sole proprietorship is your own income. It's your own profits. It's treated as your own personal income. It would be taxed, just the way any money that you make over a course of a year would be taxed. There are no special liability protections for a sole proprietorship. Whatever you do wrong, you personally are liable for. If you've breached a contract, if you've committed a tort or a crime, you individually are liable for it. Now, of course, a sole proprietorship does not necessarily mean a one-person shop. A sole proprietor can have lots of employees. It simply means that you are the only owner of the business. And these employees are your agents. They work for you. Now, because they're employees, they have a limited scope of agency. They're only allowed to be your agents within the scope of their employment. So if you have a draftsperson working for you, that draftsperson isn't allowed to go out and renegotiate your lease for space, because that's not what draftspeople do. That's something that you would do as the owner, or maybe me as your lawyer. But that would be beyond the scope of the draftsperson's employment. Fairly simple situation. It's kind of like being in a partnership. A partnership is another way of setting up an architectural firm or a law firm or any other kind of company. The easiest way to think of it is if you had two or more sole proprietorships that got combined into a single company. The major difference is that instead of one owner of the firm, you have two or more owners of the firm. There is no limit to how many partners there can be. My law firm has over 100 partners. At its height, SOM had a huge number of partners. The partners own the firm. Now they, I guess the easiest way to say it is that the laws that govern these kinds of entities, that govern sole proprietorships, partnerships, corporations, things like that, are almost always state-level laws. Yeah, there are federal tax laws, but the laws that govern doing business are almost all a function of the state. In a partnership, your partnership is governed by the Uniform Partnership Act, which is a level two on the hierarchy. being an act, it is a statute passed by the Illinois legislature. There are probably some administrative agencies who have regulations that govern partnerships or doing business as well. Plus, you're governed by court-made law. There are lots of court decisions that govern what partnerships can do and how partnerships function. But what you're primarily governed by is your own partnership agreement. Partnership agreement is number 6 on the hierarchy of laws. It's a contract. And almost all partnerships that have been set up with even the slightest degree of formality tend to have agreements between the partners, or among the partners if there are more than two. Some basic things like, what percentage do each of us own? How do we make decisions? How do we distribute income? Things like that. Those usually are the functions of a partnership agreement. Now, the Uniform Partnership Act is set up as a default law. It says that if you've provided for something in your partnership agreement, that governs the partnership. But if there's a subject you've omitted from that agreement or you haven't covered, then we'll resolve all of those the way the law, Uniform Partnership Act, says. So suppose you've forgotten to identify the percentage of ownership. There are 3 of you in this partnership, and your partnership agreement wasn't well drafted. It deals with what each of you does. One is the designer. One is responsible for technical production. The other is responsible for job site work. But it doesn't really go a whole lot beyond that. Well, the Uniform Partnership Act says when you have a partnership agreement that has forgotten to divide percentage ownership up, we'll assume it's equal. The 3 partners each own 1/3 of the firm. And if the partnership agreement doesn't specify how the revenue is to be distributed, well, then we'll assume it's equal. Everybody gets the same amount. But it doesn't have to be that way. It might be that there's 1 senior partner and 2 junior partners who have just come up the ranks and been made partner. It's not at all unusual for the senior partner to be awarded 50% of the profits of the firm, and the junior partners each split the other 50%, 25 each. There's nothing that says partnership profits have to be divided equally. The agreements can provide for almost anything at all. I have seen partnership agreements that say that we will split profits equally, but if there are losses that have to be paid, this partner doesn't have to pay them. So the percentage of loss payments or capital contributions may be different from the percentage in which fees or profits are paid. Same thing with power and control. If there are 3 partners, what kind of control does each of them have of the firm? Do they each have equal votes? Do decisions get made with 2/3 versus 1/3? Or do you need a bigger majority than that? Do you need unanimity? All of those issues can be resolved in the partnership agreement. You can agree that income is split 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, but voting power is split 52%, 24, 24. And that's perfectly legal too. There is nothing illegal or wrong about it. It just depends on what deal the partners have struck. As a partner in a partnership, you are not guaranteed an income. The general way that it works in a partnership is that your ownership ends up being a function of profit or loss. You have a lot of salaried employees. You have a lot of hard and fixed costs. You pay rent. And at the end of making all those payments, there's money left over or there's not. The money that's left over is then the profit of the firm and divided among the owners in whatever ratio has been specified in the agreement. If there's a loss and everybody has to dig into his pocket to pay the landlord, the partnership agreement governs how that is done too. Yes, but the salary is kind of the last money out. So the partnership may assign each partner a salary of $50,000, But if there isn't enough money to pay all three partners the $50,000, it's the partners who take the hit. The reason we talked about agency is how the partners relate to each other. The critical factor in a partnership is that the partners are each agents of the partnership and actually of each other as well. So a partner in a partnership has the ability to completely bind the partnership to anything at all. Not just minor stuff, but major stuff, like taking out a loan or closing the doors or whatever it might be. Partners are agents for all purposes, whereas the employees, just like in a sole proprietorship, are agents for limited purposes within the scope of their employment. By being an agent, that means that any knowledge given to one partner is attributed to the entire partnership, which means that each partner has fiduciary duties to the partnership to act in its best interests. Here's what sometimes happens. You're in a partnership with a bunch of different architects. You're all partners in some way, and you're not happy there. You've decided you want to leave the partnership and go out on your own. So you talk to several of the clients you've been working with. You find out that they really want to move with you too. So you tell them that that's what you're going to be doing, and then you leave the firm and announce, and you start up your own sole proprietorship, and then these clients move over to you. Have you done anything wrong? Yes, you have. What was wrong? Well, what was wrong was talking to those clients. Well, you're still a member of the firm. You can't be a partner in a partnership and be disloyal to the partnership. It is disloyal to your partnership to talk clients into leaving that firm and to coming to you when you're on your own. It's the sequence that's the problem. There's nothing wrong at all with quitting the partnership, hanging out your shingle and becoming a sole proprietor, and then calling up those clients and saying, I'm out on my own now, you'll be better off with me, why don't you make me your architect? That's okay, because you severed your agency relationship by quitting the partnership first. Now you no longer have fiduciary duties, and you can compete for clients like anybody else. Lawyers get involved when partners in a partnership cheat and contact the clients before they've left. And in fact, you can go to court and you can get a court order stopping the leaving partner from working with these clients because it was a consequence of his illegal contact of them. So you can really create, or worse, you can if he does continue to work with the clients, you can get a court order requiring him to pay to you the profits that he earned from that client so he isn't making any money on it. The employee still owes duties of loyalty to the partnership, to his company. So an employee really isn't allowed to go around contacting company clients and explaining what his plans are and then going out on his own and working with them. He's got to wait till he quits before he does that because he still owes the duties of loyalty.
Is loyalty limited to the scope of your duties or is it unlimited?
It's probably, I don't know of a court case that responds to this, but the logical answer is that the employee's fiduciary duties are limited to the scope of his employment because he's not an agent outside the scope of his employment. So if he's a truck driver, that doesn't mean he can't try to solicit somebody to hire him to do something unrelated to truck driving. But it's not entirely clear. That's why lawyers end up fighting about these things. No, it's a good question. Where does this duty of loyalty come from? Where is it described? Well, it's not in a statute, nor is it in a regulation. And you've probably seen employment contracts. They're not all that explicit in defining what the duty of loyalty is. It comes from court-made law, number 5 on the hierarchy of laws. And court-made law fills in the gaps that statutes leave open and the contracts don't fill in. So a court will have determined that agents owe fiduciary duties, including loyalty, and in this particular set of circumstances, loyalty means X, Y, and Z. And then future courts will read that decision and will apply it in related circumstances, and that's how the courts make their law. So that's a partnership, or at least the effect of the agency in a partnership. How is it treated as a business? Well, a partnership still is like a sole proprietorship. That means that the money that comes in that's attributed to a partner is ordinary normal income, taxed by the IRS, and it's just like any other income the person earns. There's no separation of person and company. It also means there are no special liability protections. If the company is liable for something, the principals are liable for it as well. The partners are liable. Now, there's something called a limited partnership, which is different from a regular partnership. It's more of a financing vehicle than anything else. Maybe the easiest way to illustrate this is to tell you about one or some that I'm involved in. I have a friend who produces musicals on Broadway, and he set up an investment group, which is really set up like a limited partnership, and I'm a member of this investment group. He produced some good stuff. He's responsible for shows you've seen, like The Producers and Hairspray, and he's responsible for some flops that you probably haven't seen, like Little Shop of Horrors and The Wedding Singer, and I think he's bringing a new one to Broadway in about 6 to 12 months called Leap of Faith. Ever seen the Steve Martin movie? This one's going to be very good. Wallace Esparza and Brooke Shields are starring. But in any event, my role isn't to read the scripts or to talk to or find the actors or anything like that. My role is to put up money, which is then used to pay for the various costs of mounting the production. So I would buy a share in the limited partnership, but that wouldn't really make me a partner. It would make me an investor. I have no ability to manage the show. I can't give them stage directions or tell them which theater to open up in. I have zero control of what's going on. On the other hand, the documents give me a financial return. Assuming that the play is a success and generates profits, the profits are distributed with the limited partners getting this much and the general partners getting that much. What is a general partner? A general partner is a real partner. When we're talking about partnerships, and I say that this partnership has two partners, they are both general partners. That means a partner for all purposes. Contrasting it with a limited partnership, which is really just an investment share. So going along with my lack of control as an investor is my lack of liability. If something goes wrong with the play, have you read about what's going on with Spider-Man? Where people are getting injured in the crazy stunts and stuff that Julie Traymore has been doing, then the play is liable. Now, it buys insurance, but it can be sued by the actors for the physical injuries that they suffer, and the ownership pays. And the general partners, like my friend, are really liable for that. As a limited partner, I am not liable for what the partnership does, because my role isn't truly a partner, it's more like an investor. Limited partner is the stroke, the phrase limited partner is to stroke my ego, make me feel as if I'm really involved in producing the Broadway musical rather than just investing in it. So if you ever hear talks about limited partnerships, they rarely have anything to do with the architecture or construction world, with one exception. You can set up, in fact, 20 years ago, I set up a major architectural firm as a limited partnership. Have you ever heard, you know, the firm McClear? They've been a major design, build, and architecture firm in Chicago for about 20 years. But the way that the principals, the general partners, got that firm going was to set it up as a limited partnership. They sold limited partnership shares to some very wealthy individuals who essentially financed the firm for the first year or two till it got going and on its feet. And in exchange for that, they got a certain rate of return on their investment, but had no control of the firm or anything else. They were basically investors in an architectural firm. That's the only one that I've ever heard of that's set up that way. But since you're likely to hear the term limited partnership, I wanted you to have a sense that it's just an investment. It's not really a partnership.
Does the worker mention capital?
Yeah. What, you've heard, all heard of VCs or venture capitalists investing in startup companies and things like that. What they do one of two things. They either set it up as a limited partnership where they don't have responsibility for running it or any liabilities, but they get a huge percentage of the returns. Or, as what the segue we're going into now, whoops, that's LLCs. That's not what I want. Where's corporations? Or they set it up as a corporation and own some of the shares. So thank you for the segue. Any of you see The Social Network? Oh, come on. You haven't, somebody's got to have seen that. Yeah. That's what they did with Facebook. They set it up as a corporation and sold shares of stock. And the venture capitalists that finally financed the thing ended up paying $500,000 or whatever it was into the company in exchange for a certain percentage ownership in the stock. And we'll see in a moment why ownership of the stock is a critical consideration, because it doesn't have liabilities attached to it either. Now, a corporation is totally different from the kinds of entities we were just talking about. As a sole proprietorship and a partnership, there's no distinguishing any difference between the individual and the company from a legal standpoint. Not so with corporations. Corporations are totally separate entities from the people who own them. They are deemed to be people in the eyes of the law. There was a recent U.S. Supreme Court case, I think, that even confirmed that corporations have the right to free speech, free political speech, in that they can take out ads touting one candidate or criticizing another. Corporations should be thought of as if they were individual people, except, of course, that they're incorporate. They don't have hands and arms. They're just embodiments on pieces of paper. Just like partnerships, corporations are governed by state law. Instead of the Partnership Act, there's the Business Corporation Act. Instead of a partnership agreement, there are articles of incorporation and bylaws. Now, those words are complicated and fancy, but they're basically the written rules, like a contract, that govern the corporation. Certain small corporations, where there are only a handful of shareholders, can have shareholder agreements that are actual contracts that governs what the shareholders or owners do. Now, there's a term you probably aren't familiar with, shareholders. What you need to understand is the corporate hierarchy. Think of it almost like a military setup with people having superior and inferior positions. At the very top, the owners of the corporation are the shareholders. Stockholders is another term for them. They own the shares of stock that constitute ownership of the company. The shareholders vote based on what percentage stock they own. That's how many votes they have. And they elect the board of directors. You've all heard that term probably before. A board of directors is kind of like the brain trust of the corporation. It doesn't handle the day-to-day activities of the corporation, but it makes all the important overall decisions. It's the one that decides if they're going to merge or not, if they're going to take out this major new line of credit from a bank, if they're going, who's going to be the president of the company. They'll decide who the officers are. So the big ticket decisions are made by the board of directors. The board of directors elects the officers of the corporation. The officers are people like the president, any vice presidents, the secretary and treasurer, and even smaller offices can be elected by the board of directors. And of course, the president and officers of the company are the ones who hire the employees. Now, shareholders are in a different position from everybody else in a corporation. Shareholders are not agents of the company. They do not act on behalf of the company. Everybody else does. But you can understand why. Any of you ever own any shares of stock in the stock market? I mean, suppose you bought a share of Ford Motor Company. Are you legally liable because the Ford Pinto has a gas tank problem that might cause it to explode? Could somebody sue you because you own a share of Ford Motor Company stock? Well, obviously not. You have no control in any of the details. You're not responsible for the fact that the Pinto used to explode. So, as a shareholder, you don't share the liabilities of the company. Your biggest risk is that if the company goes down the tubes, the value of your shares drops to nearly zero on the open market. But you don't have direct liability for anything that the corporation does. Nor do you have the ability to act as the agent for the company. I mean, just because you bought a share of Ford doesn't mean that you can go out and sign a contract with somebody who manufactures parts. That's just not your right. No, you have no authority to do that. The board of directors, the officers, and the employees are all agents of the company. The board of directors has the big overall decisions to make, and they have to make them on behalf of the company. So a board of the directors can't vote for the company to take out a bad loan from a bank just because one or more of the directors also happens to own that bank. That's disloyal, a breach of fiduciary duties, basically causing the corporation to take on a liability or to take on a bad loan because you happen to own the bank that's making the loan and are going to profit on it. If one of my partners is serving on the board of directors for this company, they really can't choose me to be the lawyer, at least not without doing a very careful vetting of everybody else, because that's disloyal. That's directing business to his own firm, putting his interests potentially ahead of the corporation's interests. The officers, especially the president, is the agent for all purposes, can do almost anything for the company. The president is the number one agent that's held out to the public as having all the authority. He can sign loan documents, he can rent space, he can do anything. He's the agent for all purposes. And the other officers are agents for their particular purposes. And of course you have employees who, just like being employees in any other company, are agents for the limited purposes that they've been hired for. So what's the point of being a shareholder? Why would you want to own a piece of a corporation? Well, you get certain rights as a shareholder. You don't have, they're not so direct, but they can still be valuable. One of your rights is voting for the directors, which means although you don't run the day-to-day business of the company, you can determine what its overall game plan will be. The shareholders can vote out directors who are too spendthrift and vote in directors who are going to be frugal and not overspend in order to maximize company profits. You probably heard about corporate takeovers, people like Carl Icahn who come in and try to take over companies. They do that by going to the shareholders and saying, if you vote for me and my slate of people who are loyal to me, we'll do this, that, and the other thing with your company, which will end up making more money for the company, and will come to you in the form of dividends. Dividends are the distribution of profits after all the expenses have been paid. Remember we talked about partners in a partnership getting their share of the profits at the end? The shareholders, who are the owners of the corporation, get their share of profits at the end. And that's by paying all the employees, all the officers, paying the rent and all the expenses, and whatever is left over at the end can be, doesn't have to be, distributed to the shareholders as dividends, which are essentially profits. And if the company dissolves, goes out of business, and sells everything it has, those assets, say it sells its assets, its factories and everything else, and it ends up with $1 million in cash clear at the end after this fire sale, well, that money is a pool that gets distributed to the shareholders because they own the company, in accordance with whatever their percentage ownership is. So those are the rights of a shareholder. It's not as direct as the right of a partner in a partnership, because corporations have these hierarchies with very strict limitations on what the various hierarchies can do. The trade-off for that is that there's no liability for shareholders. And that's responding to your question about how venture capitalists deal. In The Social Experiment, see, at least if I quote a movie that's recent enough, some of you guys know what I'm talking about. In The Social Experiment, the venture capitalists put in $500,000 for a certain percentage ownership of stock because, as stockholders or shareholders, they have no personal liability. The shareholders are entitled to a certain amount of control by voting for directors, certain percentage of the profits at the end from dividends, but they do not have liability for disasters by the company. So if Mark Zuckerberg had run the company into the ground and had debts owed to thousands of other people, which happens with more companies than not. I mean, Facebook was a huge, unusual example. But most internet startups like that fail disastrously. And debts are owed, and it ends up going bankrupt, owing a lot of people that it doesn't have the money to pay. But the shareholders don't have to pay for that, because no shareholder is personally liable for the debts of the corporation. The creditors are just out of luck. They could sue the company, but it doesn't have any money to pay it, so there's no point to a lawsuit. So shareholders aren't liable for acts. When the Ford Pinto explodes, the shareholders aren't responsible for the consequences. They aren't responsible for the debts. But unlike a partnership, unlike a sole proprietorship, there are weird tax and accounting treatments for the way money flows in a corporation. The IRS has a very complex set of rules governing corporate tax. Lawyers spend an entire year studying corporate tax in law school because it's so complicated, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. Here are some examples. Unlike a partnership, because in a partnership, if you're a 50% partner, you may only get 33% of the income. So you're only taxed on 33% of the income, because you can do that in a partnership. You can't do it in a corporation. In a corporation, if you are a one-third shareholder, then one-third of whatever that corporation makes is going to be attributable to you. You can be a one-third partner for purposes of income, but have 50% control of the company, not in a corporation. In a corporation, whatever share of stock you have, that controls your income, it controls your power or your voting for the board of directors. Dividends are often not even paid in a corporation. They're reinvested because there's a double tax treatment. The corporation is a person, right? So when the corporation makes money, suppose there's a net of $1 million profit, the corporate income tax is levied, and the corporation has to pay tax on that money. So that $1 million is reduced now down, say, to $700,000 by paying $300,000 in taxes. Then the $700,000 is distributed to the shareholders as dividends, and it's taxed again because it's income to them personally. And that means that same set of profits has been taxed twice, one at the corporate level and one at the personal level, and that's bad business. So there are all kinds of things that corporations do to reinvest their money rather than paying it out as dividends, and that leads to all kinds of complexities in tax and accounting that are way beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about here, because I'm not trying to make you into lawyers or accountants, just to understand the complexities when you open up your own architectural shop. One exception to all of this no liability issue is what's called piercing the corporate veil. Piercing the corporate veil means that the owners of the corporation haven't been serious about treating it like a corporation. A corporation is a separate person. It has its own bank accounts. It has its own letterhead. And if an owner of a corporation is mixing and commingling, mixing his own personal funds of accounts in with the corporate accounts, using his personal letterhead to do corporate business, then a court could find that the owners, the shareholders of the corporation, aren't really treating it like a corporation. They're not doing what's called observing the corporate formalities. They're not treating it as if it were truly separate. And if the owners don't treat it like a truly separate person, then a court won't either. And then court will say, this corporate identity or this corporate entity is really a fiction. It doesn't really exist. So whatever liabilities it has pass through to the owners. And the owners do become liable in that rare instance for corporate liabilities and debts. Which means that if you run your architectural firm like a corporation, you need to run it carefully. You need to keep corporate minute books. You need to follow all the little rules and details that corporate law requires. And if you don't, then the benefits of working, of setting it up like a corporation may not apply. So it's beyond the scope of this class to teach you those details, which you won't remember anyway. You just need to remember that if or when you practice architecture in a corporation, that you've got to talk to an accountant or a lawyer or something to make sure you're doing it right. Now, you've probably heard of things called professional corporations, because it used to be that the way to practice architecture was through a professional corporation. There really isn't a difference between a professional corporation and an ordinary corporation anymore. The Professional Corporation Act in Illinois is kind of obsolete. It used to be popular to set up a professional corporation to practice architecture because it had certain benefits, and it really isn't anymore. Other states, it may be different. But at least if you're practicing in Illinois, you can kind of forget about the idea of professional corporations. Nobody uses them anymore. Question?
If shareholders, officers, directors, or employees are not liable for corporate taxes, who is?
Very good question. If all of these agents and shareholders aren't liable for a corporate act, who is?
Corporation.
Exactly. The corporation is a person. It's just like a person. When the corporation does something wrong, even if it's through the actions of an employee or something like that, the CTA bus driver who hits somebody, the CTA is a kind of a municipal corporation, the corporation itself is liable. And that means that the assets of the corporation, whatever the corporation owns, may be ordered to be paid to the injured party. Corporations buy insurance to cover that so that if they do get hit with a liability, the insurance company ends up paying it off. That's pretty much how it works. That means that, I mean, it's a very wise question because developers have figured that out. Do you know how condominiums are developed today? You'll never find a major developer developing a condominium structure or even anything these days in his own name. They set up a separate company, often a corporation, often an LLC, which we'll talk about next, to be the developmental entity. And they purposely don't keep any assets in that corporation or company except for the building itself. So that when the condominium is built, if there are defects in it or violations of the developer's warranty, condo associations sue all the time. And the developer's protection is that the development company that's set up doesn't have any money, which means that they can get all the judgments they want against the development company, but there's nothing to pay with, and no other people are liable. It's a way of separating the liability from the human beings and sticking it just in a corporation that has no assets to pay. And that's how developers evade that kind of liability. They don't really feel much of a financial impact except perhaps on their business reputation. So they do have an interest in developing the next property, and if they're known as being slumlords, nobody's going to buy a condo in their building. So they want their reputation to remain unblemished, but they don't want to pay a lot of money to do that. So they might fund the litigation for the corporation a little bit or try to settle things cheaply. But what they'll do is they'll go to the condo association and say, listen, you've got two options. One is to fight to the death, get a big judgment if you win against my corporation and never collect a penny of it and be out all the money you've spent on your lawyers. Or I could offer you $20,000 now to make this claim go away, and you'll be a lot better off than if you fought me. And what does the condo association do? Because the developer is right. So they often settle very cheaply, which means that buying a condo can be a very dangerous investment because you end up being liable for all the defects in the building and have nobody else to lay them off on. I mean, a huge industry is condo associations suing their architects these days or their contractors because the developers have left them high and dry. I'm actually representing a condo association in the northern suburbs where we worked out a deal with the developer in exchange for us as the condo association agreeing not to try to collect any money out of the developer's pocket. The developer admitted that the architect and contractor screwed up. It was actually a design build company that he hired, and assigned to us the rights to collect from them. So now it's the condo association versus the designer and contractor operating through the developer. And that's kind of a unique solution, but it gives you an idea of how developers use these laws to protect themselves from liability and from your fees. If the developer ends up owing you $50,000 for your last couple of invoices and he's got a company with no assets in it, how the heck are you going to collect? You need to be very careful to make arrangements for those payments to be made to you either in advance or in an escrow or some other legal arrangement so that you'll have a real remedy to collect your fees if the developer stiffs you. And believe me, developers stiff people all the time. That could happen. One possibility is to have the individual who owns the development company guarantee the performance, including the payments, so that there's an individual person who's on the hook. Because that's very effective, the individual developers generally refuse. And again, it's probably beyond the scope of this class for me to sit and tell you all the different legal tricks and maneuvering that you might try to do. My job here is to make you aware of these issues, because 5 years from now, you're going to be practicing on your own, and these issues are going to be important. And I don't expect anybody to have memorized the details of what we're talking about in class, but when you get your first big assignment from a condo developer, if you're smart, you'll remember that the import of this lesson is that there are a lot of ways that they can screw you by operating through a corporation, and that you really should talk to somebody to get advice on how to counteract that. Another way that you can set up a company that is an individual, like a corporation, is a limited liability company, sometimes abbreviated LLC. A limited liability company is a hybrid. It's got some elements of a corporation in it and some elements of a partnership. We'll talk about those elements in a moment. The key is that LLCs are relatively new. Corporations have been involved longer than the United States. They've been around since medieval England. So there's a huge body of court-made law that's developed around them, and everybody knows how they work. LLCs are 20 to 30 years old in terms of concept. Before that, the concept of a hybrid partnership corporation didn't exist. So there hasn't been much time, relatively, for there to be a big body of law that's built up around them. So what I'm telling you now is pretty much what people believe about LLCs. It's probably correct, but I can't guarantee to you that there are court decisions that pronounce all this to be true. So an LLC is a separate legal entity, the same way that a corporation is. It's deemed to be a person for liability-type purposes. But it has the tax and accounting treatment of a partnership, much simpler than a corporation. That's why this entity was invented, because people wanted the liability protections of a corporation, but the simple tax and accounting treatment of a partnership. And that's really the essence of an LLC. It's governed by state law, just like a corporation. Instead of the Business Corporation Act, you have the Illinois Limited Liability Company Act. There's not a whole lot of law that's built up around it, but most of the arrangements in a company like this are made in what's called an operating agreement, which is like a partnership agreement or like corporate bylaws. It's like the contract among the company's owners that determines what the rules will be inside the company. Now, like a partnership, you can have a 50% owner in terms of power who only gets 33% of the profits and 25% of the losses. You can set up disparate amounts of ownership in various different areas through the operating agreement. It's the flexibility of a partnership. It's got the hierarchy, the management hierarchy, of a corporation, however, or at least it's similar, not exactly the same. Instead of shareholders, you have members who are owners. Members own the LLC. Instead of having officers and directors, you have managers of the LLC who are the agents for running all the business of the LLC. And of course, it has employees just the way a corporation would have employees. So members are the equivalent of shareholders, and managers are the equivalent of officers and directors. Yes?
What's the downside of this and the ability to invest in it?
This is a really good question. Personally, I don't think there is a downside. The only downside is that you don't have 500 years of well-established law to govern all the ramifications of something like this. Nevertheless, the concept is pretty clear, so I don't see that there are major problems, which is why my recommendation is that LLCs are usually the best vehicles for setting up your own companies. They give you the maximum flexibility and the minimum risk and exposure. It's really a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. The only potential difference is that the Illinois Secretary of State charges more than twice as much to set up an LLC as it does to set up a corporation. Neither one is really expensive. It's a couple hundred dollars to set up a corporation. It's maybe $500 to set up an LLC. If you're just starting out, maybe that's a significant difference, but in the long run, it's pretty trivial.
Is there minimum capital requirements for setting up these things?
There are no legal minimum capital requirements for setting up either a corporation or an LLC. There may be capital requirements in the operating agreement, but that's the voluntary agreement among the owners. But the law doesn't require it. On the other hand, when the courts are trying to determine whether to pierce the corporate veil, remember that was the exception for liability that we talked about, one of the factors that the courts will consider is how well-financed the company is. If there's virtually no money in the company, then a court might hold that that's one of the factors involved in the company being a fiction and piercing the corporate veil. All by itself, it's probably not enough, because developers get away with this all the time, but it is one factor to take into account. So from my standpoint, it makes no sense to set up an architecture firm, really, as anything but an LLC these days. If you want to look at this chart, you'll see the various benefits that the different entities have. The sole proprietorship and the partnership have very flexible tax and accounting treatment, but no special liability shield or protection. The corporation protects you from liability if you're an owner or a shareholder, but its tax and accounting treatment is pretty difficult to live with. The LLC is the best of both worlds, and for my money, it's the smart way to set up your architectural firm. Now, setting up an architectural firm, going into business for yourself, is a pretty complicated endeavor. What I've explained to you here are the legal structures that you can use. But the most important thing is having good advice. As architects, I don't expect you ever to be in a situation where you know all of these rules and have them memorized. It's important for you to be aware that the issues are out there, but you need to develop consultants or experts in various different areas. If you are going into business for yourself, and we'll talk about this in detail on the last class before the final, one of the things that you want to do is to have an accounting business type person who can work with you to set up appropriate accounting procedures, who can work with you technologically savvy enough so that they can set up your computer system to handle credits and debits, expenses, income, and all that kind of stuff. QuickBooks and all the other standard software is sensible and usable by an architectural firm, but there are all kinds of tricks and reasons you have, things you have to understand to run it. I once tried just figuring out QuickBooks on my own briefly for an organization that I was personally involved with, and I figured I would have had to have spent 50 hours to really understand how it worked fully and to use it all. You're way better off having somebody consult with you and teach you the steps you need in order to accomplish your purposes. We're going to spend an entire class talking about insurance, or most of a class. Insurance comes in all different shapes and forms. It's a smart idea for almost any of the companies, especially the ones who have their own liability. I mean, a corporation or an LLC almost never has the assets to pay a loss unless it's purchased insurance. You need to develop a working relationship with an insurance broker who can teach you about the different kinds of insurance and help you find the cheapest ones. You need a relationship with a lawyer of some kind to help walk you through these minefields. But this is a sense of the different entities, how they're set up, and how they function. And they all turn on the agency relationship. Even in the LLC, you have agents. The members are not agents because they're just owners, just like shareholders are not agents. But the managers are and the employees are for limited purposes. Question? It's a good question. Does size have anything to do with the entity you choose? Not really. There are certain extra flexibilities that small corporations have that big ones don't. But companies that start out small may end up bigger. So the wise thing to do is to start with an LLC in the first place. And the rules governing an LLC for big ones, for small ones, are exactly the same. They're just simpler to operate, obviously, when they're small. Now, next week, we're going to start the most important concept in the class. We're going to start to learn the law of contracts. There's no type of law that matters more in the architectural profession than the law of contracts. And we're going to do it in two steps. The first couple of classes are going to be the theory of contracts, how the law functions in theory, although I'll try to pull all my examples from the architectural and construction industry to make them as practical as possible. And after that, we're going to analyze the B101 contract in detail. You need, for the next 2 weeks, you're fine not having it, but when we start talking about the B101 contract, the AIA document that I asked you to purchase, you're going to be totally lost without it. So by the time we get to that, make sure you have it and make sure you bring it to class, because by far the easiest way to keep track of things is to have the contract in front of you and to take notes in the margins, and you'll be able to bring those notes into the midterm. So it's the easiest way to do things by far. Any last questions before I actually do something rare and let you out early? Well, great. I will see you next week, same time, same place.